Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and each week on the show, we will talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. In this episode, I talk with Angie Boersma, who founded Ideate, to be unapologetically rural. She is an intentional generalist, leveraging a variety of skills beyond architecture. She combines experience in interior design, civic leadership, local legislation, and financing to serve rural communities. These communities have a variety of needs, and it takes more than an architect to bring these projects through to completion. Angie has broadened her impact by working on the regulatory side of civic leadership to work within the community to decide what infrastructure can be changed. She spent time within the ranks of those regulating projects on local boards. Diving into these various roles gave her insight into the priorities of people who have the power to say no to her and her clients. Angie's practice is like an American Dipper. As a songbird, the American Dipper shares a story for all to hear. It is also the only songbird that can swim. It lives alongside streams and waterfalls, diving into the turbulent waters, and it still comes out singing on the other side. Angie also dives outside the element of traditional architectural design to create lasting impact in the rural communities she serves. Well, welcome, Angela Boersma. This is the Flying Solo Podcast, where we talk about how architects are taking flight to follow their dreams. And you have taken flight and carved a new path for yourself in South Dakota, my home state. And so it's really great to hear how things are going. Where are you practicing?
I'm based in Brookings, South Dakota, which is about 45 minutes from my hometown of Pipestone, Minnesota. And so it's a close to my heart, close to home place to set up a practice. And I've been in Brookings for the better part of 20 years, spread over undergrad and now post grad school. So
very exciting. And for context, when I was going through school, there wasn't an accredited program in South Dakota. And so had to leave the state to pursue this career. But it's so great to see how many architects are returning to South Dakota and bringing the practice and design back.
It's really fun. So when I came back to Brookings as a professor, I was actually teaching in the interior design program because I'm dual degreed. So interior design as an undergrad and then graduate school for architecture. And they were just starting the architecture program when I was back on campus. And so I was part of the first hiring committees that brought all of our new architecture faculty and got all of those that new field of study for SDSU started. And it was a really fun time to be on campus, really exciting to meet all the students. And now it's really fun to see how many students have been educated at SDSU continue to populate the architectural community in South Dakota.
Very exciting. I hear a lot of things that remind me of your firm, that you were ideating this new program in Brookings, and also your rounded design education to have architecture interiors just paired together so beautifully. That sort of shaped your firm.
Very much so. Yeah. At the time that I was an undergrad, you know, because there was no architectural studies, a lot of folks suggested that the faculty in the interior design program, two of them were trained in architecture as well as interiors. And so that was kind of the best way to get into architecture as a pre-professional program that was not architecture per se, but it gives you another set of marketable skills. And so that was kind of the suggestion. And I paired that with a minor in economics and hospitality management, those kinds of things, because I really wanted to design restaurants and hotels and all of those kinds of things, and have found myself dabbling in that, but doing a lot of other things because it's rural South Dakota. So,
and why stop at the building, continue to design what people are touching inside the building, but also the reason they're coming and that experience that they have when they're in the space. I love
That's totally true. I think the cool part of a little bit of hospitality management and interior design is it really made me think about architecture through the lens of experience design, which is maybe different than a lot of people start in the profession thinking about. I think a lot of times in studios that maybe comes a little bit later. And for me, that was kind of foundational to how I even started thinking about architecture.
I love that. And I see a lot of foundational values on your website: to ideate, to create, to advocate. What three words would you actually use to describe your firm?
That's tough, actually. I was talking about it with my team because we've been on a marketing journey, and our team is 4 designers and then 1 part-time admin. Happens to be my mom, which is even better. But just talking to our design team and understanding, you know, guys, as we think about this, the last several years in particular, we identify ourselves first and foremost as unapologetically rural specialists, where other firms might be hospitality or healthcare or residential specialists, we're really unapologetically rural specialists. And it requires that we be very intentional generalists. I think the architecture of rural places is so diverse and the needs are so diverse that you've got to be a really great generalist. So I would say that's probably first, unapologetically rural. I think we're really excellent generalists. And I think that sort of education advocacy focus, very civic minded. Our whole team, me included, but our whole team is very civic minded in terms of creating a better community. We want to create rural communities that we want to live in and that other people want to live in and that professionals want to plant their lives in so that it doesn't end up being kind of the brain drain that you start to hear in rural places that everybody worries about. I want people to want to be here.
And for those who don't know, what is brain drain from a rural community?
Yeah, so it's when you export all of your brightest and best intellectuals and professionals to other areas of the country, more urban areas where opportunities abound, as opposed to rural places where frequently those opportunities are 1 or 2, as opposed to dozens of different opportunities to work in an architectural firm. So in Brookings, for example, we only have 2 architectural firms. There are like 4 licensed architects in the entire city. And so it's a really interesting place. There might be 5, 6, 8, but not many. So it's a really interesting place to set up a practice because you're serving 25,000 in this community directly, 35,000 in our county. But we serve a 6-state area of all rural communities, and we tend to find those communities because they like that we are rural and we speak the same language. They don't necessarily want the like city firm coming in and telling them how to do these things. We understand navigating things where you're advocating just as much for rural electric as you are for figuring out a new sewer and water project as you are a water treatment plant. You know, like there's some of those kinds of things that are maybe different in rural places.
Ooh, we're going to get into that.
Sure.
But real fast, how would you define rural?
In our case, I would say it's areas where the nearest kind of metropolitan statistical area is maybe 30 minutes away. And frequently less than 50,000 people. So the communities that we're working in fall into that less than 50,000. So it's places where USDA rural development kind of plays differently than you have in kind of urban census areas.
That's fascinating. I had dove into this because I transferred into Minnesota from South Dakota, and I mm-hmm. just wanted to get a sense of how big the state was and how all these big towns were here. But looking at the data, it's 600 towns. 1/6 of them are over 10,000. Mm-hmm. 2/6 of them, so a third, are between like 1,000 and 10,000. And mm-hmm. then half the towns are less than 1,000 people. And that blew my mind because it's like, yeah. Oh, I grew up in a small town of 5,000 people. But it was more that I was, well, my half of the state, Western South Dakota, had 1 mall at the time.
Yeah.
And when I was growing up, there were 3 escalators in the whole state. But that has exploded and changed since then. But it changed my perspective of what it meant to serve rural communities when it's less than 1,000 people who are benefiting from a community center. It's no longer serving and drawing from a single town, from a single town's budget. It's looking at a county level or a tri-county level or tri-city level. And that just throws the game out of whack because you have 3 different sets of politics or more at play. And so I think it's very fascinating to hear about your career. Could you tell us how you started to shape your career with this civic-minded aspect paired with your practice?
Yeah, it's a, I don't know that I fell into it necessarily, but I, I sort of stumbled my way through and into politics because I had a really hard time having people tell me no, to be really frank. And so I learned over the course of, you know, 6, 8, 10 years at the beginning of my career that in serving in civic boards, a lot of times those are not regulatory boards. They're advisory boards to city council, to a county commission, to a municipal utility board. And those advisory boards provide a recommendation, but they have actual, like, no regulatory authority in any way, shape, or form. And so I served on a historic preservation commission for 2 terms, was the chair for 2 or 3 years. And we did an awesome, awesome amount of very cool projects. But when it came right down to it, we kept running into the situation where we would make a recommendation, and I'm the kind of required licensed architect on that board, so there has to be at least one licensed professional represented on that board. And I could go to city council and make a recommendation, and they would completely ignore me. And so that was one of those kinds of things that was so frustrating, that if I don't get myself in a position where I'm not making a recommendation to the authority, I am the authority. I want to be a part of the conversation that decides, not the one that makes a recommendation for the decision. And so that sort of led me through a pathway of deciding to serve on county commission. And in part because we're rural, you do need this sort of coalition of multiple communities, the ability to speak multiple political languages for people, to appease people in multiple areas. You have to understand the difference between commercial property and residential property and rural versus urban versus township versus, I mean, all of those kinds of things. And walked into office because nobody wanted that job, right? So it was 2019. I put my petition in 2018, within a couple weeks of when I started this firm, honestly, because I knew I couldn't run for office when I was at the previous place that I was. So I made the decision to put in a petition. Nobody else ran against me. I was encouraged by a number of people in the community, so I was relatively confident it was a good idea. And so 2019 to 2022, of course, we all know what happened with COVID. South Dakota was a crappy place to be for a lot of reasons, but not the least of which was that we had 4 or 5 major FEMA disaster declarations in those same 4 years that we also had COVID. So I just spent a lot of years as that sort of civic-minded citizen architect, I would say, on master planning commissions, on task forces for affordable housing, on historic preservation commission, and then finally just ran for office because I was tired of beating my head up against a wall and not being able to sit at the table where the decision was finally made.
I think a lot of architects are not educated. At least I wasn't. I should speak for myself. I feel like I did not get an education about what civic process was. And we go through civics in like 7th, 8th grade in our home state. And when you change locations, it's almost a different ballgame. And so I feel like making people aware, making architects aware, and I know AIA has gone through this movement to encourage citizen architecture or architects to step up into those positions, but just saying it doesn't clarify the difference between a planning commission and the school board or city council or mayorship. And so it's very helpful to hear about your process, having been in so many different positions, and you kind of start out. Do you feel like you learned things in those earlier commissions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that was a valuable stepping stone to understand civic process before you march in and say, I'm going to turn in a petition for running for office. Because in that particular situation, most people have to build constituency before you have the ability to run for office. And by serving on all of those boards and understanding the needs of the community in ways that you would not have otherwise, right? If you were never a part of a civic board, if you're never a part of a nonprofit board, if you're never a part of, I mean, I was part of the domestic abuse shelter board. And so there's a handful of these kinds of things that teach you about who the citizens of your community actually are. What are the concerns that we're constantly dealing with? How can I help as an architect? Like truly, I'm a great problem solver. And I'm a really good mediator when it comes to figuring out how do we create a win-win as much as possible. And that serves me well in politics, for sure. But I would have no idea how that process works or even starts if I hadn't served on some of those volunteer boards at the beginning.
And I'm not sure how to recommend any better way of learning it than to go out there and volunteer and get started. Because do you have a better way?
No, because I've watched folks who want to run for city council show up to city council meetings for the 3 months prior to an election, thinking they're going to learn everything that they can, but they've never served on another board. And there's no way that you get as much information as if you're engaging consistently, regularly, as a committed part of one of those volunteer boards for a 3-year term prior to kind of accelerating into that next level.
To shift gears, you Sure. are serving rural communities at, Mm-hmm. specifically. Some architects are able to define their marketing region by geography, but Mm-hmm. usually it's someone who's like, okay, I live in this county. I want all of my projects to be in this county or the adjacent. I will know the zoning codes. I will know the things. And so there's a benefit to having that geographic definition for your practice. Like there's a fence around what kind of projects you're going to take, and you can kind of specialize.
Yep.
But to generalize and to understand the systems of a diverse range of rural communities, how are you shaping your practice in order to seek out these clients and serve them to the best of your abilities?
So we really talk about the two things that bring clients to us are relationships and referrals. And referrals only happen because of relationships. So at the end of the day, it's all about building a really good relationship with people. Almost every project that we work on is a relationship-driven project. And so we might be in Gillette, Wyoming, working on a food service facility. But part of the reason that we're there is that we've got friends who know that we did a great job for them in that same food service franchise in Brookings, in other places, and the franchise team loves us. And so we get recommended because we build really strong relationships and we've been successful at doing that. I think a lot of those kinds of things mean that people find us when they don't even know they need us. But because our network kind of spreads over a 5-6 state area and we intentionally cultivate relationships, people find us, and or we find them because we hear about a problem and we love to step in and help solve a problem. So it's an interesting marketing strategy in that we do a terrible job of marketing to direct people. We do a great job of marketing to other business entities, to communities. As a former county commissioner, I understand what their counties are working through and some of the challenges that are going around the state of South Dakota, some of the folks in the state of Minnesota as well. I was pretty active in the National Association of County Officials, and so I met a lot of people from around the country. And so then you get kind of tied in, and people start to remember that you're that county commissioner that's an architect, and when they have a project or a problem that they don't know how to solve, I get a phone call, which is super interesting when folks from Utah call me, and I'm like, I'm not licensed out there, but I can probably get it in reciprocity and give you some advice later. And they're like, okay, yeah, that would be great. So then you just end up working with people literally kind of spread all over the region. And frankly, it helps me be more civic minded here because I see how the permitting process works in Gillette, Wyoming, in Omaha, Nebraska, in Bowman, North Dakota. And so as you continue to do projects in other municipalities, you kind of accumulate this wealth of knowledge that helps you go advocate back to our city council and say, we really need an ordinance about this, or this needs to be rewritten. And so then I'm engaging in that way to try and advocate for things that make the architectural process, the engineering process, the building process here work differently, better, more streamlined, those kinds of things.
Very exciting. And so what are some specific ways, if you're willing to share, that you are nurturing those relationships? Are you sending newsletters? Are you doing like the categorical marketing things? Or is it more informal than that, where you just, hey, was thinking about you, sent an email or give a little call?
A lot of times it's sending an email out or sending a phone call or the occasional text message. But in some cases, if they're in our region, we bond deeply over things like the South Dakota State University Jackrabbits, which is why I'm constantly in blue. It's hobo week. And so for nobody that understands this, right, this is such a South Dakota thing. But we will invite folks to come back and tailgate with us, or we'll invite clients to a volleyball game or those kinds of things. And through university athletics, that's kind of a big piece of how we kind of engage a lot of the folks that we work with here locally, but in some cases more broadly as well, because there are alumni everywhere. And so that turns into a whole other referral network. So there's some of that as well. And if I'm driving through, so for example, I do a lot of traveling personally for fun. And so if I'm driving through on my way to Bozeman to visit friends, I'm going to call the folks in Gillette and stop in and see them, and we'll have a visit and have lunch and catch up, and just kind of maintaining those kinds of personal relationships, I think, is an important part of it as well.
How do you feel like you built this firm and built this structure for Ideate out of your own strengths and your own interests?
That's a great question. I think the fact that I was an educator first is an interesting part of my story. And then the other piece of that is I spent a lot of years in design build. And so surrounded by family members and community members who were builders, as well as kind of thinking about major subcontractors, like my uncle's a plumber, another is an electrician, others are general contractors and developers. And so I spent a lot of my childhood like being around job sites and people who talk about construction and design and those kinds of things. I think in the design of the firm, because putting a firm together is very much a design project as well. And so in figuring out the design of the firm, understanding that the people that we want on our team are people who respect contractors and tradespeople and view them as valuable team members. I never want to be in an antagonistic relationship with a construction professional. And it's a core value I will not apologize for in any way, shape, or form. And we specifically cultivate those kinds of relationships because I learned so much as an intern working in a design build setting from superintendents and foremen, and those kinds of folks were so formative to my growth as an architect. And so that was part of the kind of design process of the firm, is making sure that our team had similar values, that I get them on job sites. I don't ever want to be the size of a firm where I stick someone in a corner desk and they never set foot on a job site. I don't want to be the kind of firm that subdivides you design and you draw and you do CA. It is your project from start to finish because you're cultivating a relationship first and foremost. Like, you are also designing. Yes, you're solving a problem, but you're cultivating a relationship throughout. And so those are kind of core tenets of the way that we practice that I think help to make things make sense for our team. And it accelerates the learning curve. And because I loved to teach, that learning curve and helping people who want to accelerate the learning curve and understand what it's like to be in a small firm, you don't have the same kind of opportunity to work on huge projects in a small firm, in a small team, in a rural community. But you have the opportunity to work on a really wide variety of projects and get involved in everything from marketing to detailing to customer service related things to the financials. Like, we talk about all of that very openly, and they get to learn about what it means to run a firm as an intern. And so those kinds of opportunities and making sure that I'm educating our own team is core to who we are.
I felt that same draw to the breadth mm-hmm. of education, starting in a 10 and then 20 person firm, because I loved doing different things every day. And yeah. that was just something that defined me. I was sitting next to people who love doing whatever they were doing right. All the time. Some who would just love to live in SketchUp their whole career, and that can work for them, but it wasn't the right fit for me. Right. And so seeking out those opportunities to have a broader education. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible when you find architects like yourself who do value educating younger staff and upcoming staff to be as strong as they can be. And understanding that grows your firm holistically. It doesn't replace you. It just grows everything you're able to do.
Right.
So I'm right there with you. So valuable.
I think it just makes such a difference in the learning experience as a emerging professional. It's intimidating how much you have to learn and how quickly you're expected to learn it. I think in a lot of cases, like as much as it sounds crazy, Like, I love throwing a hard hat on a bunch of interns and taking them on job site tours, even though they're completely out of their depth, but there's no better way to learn than to see it. And I just, I love it when things start to click for them. Like, I brought a couple of our junior staff to a 6 o'clock in the morning concrete pour because they have to understand why a specification exists the way that it exists. What are tolerances and why is that important? And there's no better way to do that than to watch someone screed concrete and understand what that process looks like. And so they were like, oh, the light bulbs just turn on and everything makes so much more sense. And then specifications are less scary because they understand the process of how you get there and how do you enforce it.
And it's so relevant when our software's kitty corner us into 1/250 inch details, and it's that's not realistic. There is precision, but it's not that type of precision,
right?
And the reference point you're giving, what if they can't get to the grid line that's in the middle of a wall of an undetermined width?
Right.
Are you drawing things that are relevant to the people who are doing it? And you're right. We get into the drawing so much and we understand the lines. But if you don't understand that line is also this piece of plastic people have to work around and turn. Mm-hmm. And it has to work with existing conditions. It just is so important. And I love that about the AXP program that mm-hmm. architects have to go through, that it structures that and requires that full breadth of education. But to go above and beyond and just integrate it into how they're learning and how your architecture firm is structured. It's also the tone that you teach on the job site, because you will be questioned by a contractor and there will be friction at times, just like you probably encounter in council meetings different opinions about how things are done. And for me, people throw their years of experience at me for like, oh, this is how we've always done it. And it's like, there's a detail here. Hate to be the architect, but and I say that coming from a family of carpenters and appreciating the trade so much because they do such incredible work. And it's my favorite thing is to interact with people who are doing the work. Mm-hmm. But there are some opinions, and this is a stereotype, or at least I have encountered it just like once or twice, not often, but once or twice where there's a thought that, hey, I've been doing this for years. I've been a contractor for years. And here you're coming in and telling me to do it a different way. And I don't think that's going to look good. Why should I do it your way? Mm-hmm. And so just because it's on the drawings isn't always a good enough reason. And so sometimes you need to play the political game and lead them through the conversation, through the idea of the drawings. And I feel like that's something that I've had to navigate since starting my own firm 4 years ago.
Sure.
Is figuring out those conversations. Is there anything that you've encountered, best practices for navigating and setting up the right tone between that design build friction that sometimes happens?
You know, the thing that I learned in the context of an actual design build firm was that if we had something that we weren't sure was going to work or look good, we would frequently take the conversation to the shop. And it was one of the things that I appreciated deeply, especially when it came to foremen and superintendents. So they would show me what or how it had to be done in order to fit properly or do this thing properly. And we would go back and forth and we'd be standing on site or else we'd build a mock-up in the shop. And if it can be done and it makes the most sense, it might not be the world's like most common way to do it, but there might be different ways that I don't know, or there might be different solutions that they hadn't thought of because they've been exposed to exactly two ways to do this one thing ever. And so a lot of times I think taking it to a very practical place, and that I spend a lot of time building things myself. And I think that helps lend to my credibility because ultimately I'm like, no, I've literally just, I've installed this detail and I'm not that great of a carpenter. So here's how I'd like it done. And it's not ridiculous. And it's not, this is the way that it should be done. And so sometimes that helps. Take it to the shop.
I feel like I'm talking to myself. I also love to do my own projects at home because you learn so much from it and you understand how hard it is to mud a perfectly smooth wall and how much time that takes, and it gives context to the work involved. And it is quite impressive how much faster professionals are at those details.
Totally agree. I love that, because to your point, the subcontractor, the actual craftsman of that thing, you start to learn really quickly which subcontractors are like-minded professionals who care deeply about their craft. And like, I will do everything to attract them to our projects.
That is another level of politics in the in the bidding process, especially with public buildings.
Yeah.
And needing to procure three bids all the time.
Yeah.
You want the best. You know they're going to be good for a project. They understand it well. And you know there's a couple other bids that are kind of coming in blind. Mm-hmm. And giving context to that as professionals when helping a client walk through that bid opening. There's things we put in place to make sure everyone's on site for pre-bid meetings and things like that. But it's interesting to navigate.
It is, especially in rural places. I think that you don't necessarily have your pick. There's literally four subcontractors that can even do this work in this area. And so you learn pretty quickly who the ones are that are diligent about making sure that they're reading specifications and who's never cracked a spec book open. And so there's some of those kinds of things that necessitate different delivery methods, like the more frequent use of CMR as a delivery method in South Dakota. And I think it happens more and more frequently where you do, in the best interest of the public interest, need someone to help qualify bidders. And so it's not always the most appropriate to go with a low bidder. It's sometimes appropriate to have additional conditions that are a requirement of this scope of work. And so we've just found that on public projects in particular, we've had more success in that realm because we've got one more set of eyes that's helping to qualify folks.
That's great. And so that's another point, that your firm is such a generalist. You're offering a breadth of services. How do you build a practice when you're doing everything from master planning through CMR.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. I think the other thing that is unique about the way that I approach architecture is we also do development. So I have a company that's a development company. And so I've worked with a lot of different contractors. Everything from a handyman on a bathroom remodel to very large scale, multi-state companies that partner with locals in order to get the kind of expertise that you need on a $40 million hotel and historic preservation project. And so I think building relationships at a lot of different scales has served us well, but it also allows us to weather economic uncertainty in a very different way than a lot of other firms, because all of our eggs are not in one basket. So in times where things are booming in the private sector, we spend a lot of time working with developers. And in times where it's leaner, I've got a lot that I can lean on in terms of public process and consulting to help folks understand public projects and our ability to kind of expertly navigate that because of background and policy. And so we can kind of pull levers in different ways and kind of lean our marketing efforts into one or the other as we start looking at economic forecasting, which is something that is also probably a little bit, I think a lot of people probably do it, but not necessarily overtly. But that kind of diversity is something that we very intentionally seek out, so that one of the rules I had when I started the firm was I never want to lay someone off because of a lack of work. So I want to build a permanent pipeline where we are also developing our own work so that I never have to lay off staff. And that was just a philosophical thing that is perpetually a goal for me, to make sure that I'm prepared for those kinds of things.
And it's so fascinating to see more architects delving into that range, because we have the ideas, and like, you felt that pressure of wanting to see these ideas take form, and you're doing it through the decision maker role. Mm-hmm. And through then the financial backer role, where you're taking on some of that risk. And I think there's a tradition that architects are very adverse to risk. And yeah. I am too. I frankly had to know my firm was going to, like, I had to have everything planned before mm-hmm. I stepped into that role. And so how are you navigating that and growing so much with only four designers in your practice?
Shortly before this time last year, last summer, there were 10 of us. And through kind of summer internships, we had a handful of interns. We hosted four interns last summer, which I have decided that was not my best move, because there's still only one of me. but understanding that as our team grows, their expertise also grows. And so their ability to continue to think through more complex projects as they mature as emerging professionals, it's like constantly having something new to get them excited about. And I think we pace things in a really intentional way. I have an absolute rule that no more than 10% over on overtime. So absolutely nobody, except for me as the business owner, because I'm really good at telling other people what they're allowed to do and not allowed to do, but not so much following it myself. Do as I say, not as I do. None of my staff is supposed to work more than 44 or 45 hours a week, right? So it's a 10% cap on overtime. So we strive to make sure that we're objectively planning how long is it actually going to take, who's actually staffing this project, and with the actual schedules and actual hours, what's realistic in terms of our workload. And so making sure that we're not overstretched, but having enough variety in projects is actually a really fun design project for me and our project management team. So I like it.
And it's a good place for you to be planning it. And yeah, it makes everyone's time more valuable.
Right.
Can I ask, because you kind of had to prepare this for the Young Architects Award,
sure,
that you won this year, the National, yeah, 2024 Young Architects Award, what is a through line as you're seeing all these other opportunities open up to you? What are you saying, yes, that's what I'm going to put my efforts in because I only have so much time and it seems like you're accomplishing everything, but I'm sure some things have to be trimmed away to be, mm-hmm, able to apply yourself to the things that matter most.
I think the ability to recognize that everything is a season. Nothing that I'm doing is forever, right? I would love to say that that's the case, but even public service and county commission, a lot of the volunteer boards, when I made the decision to go from volunteer board citizen architect to elected official, volunteer boards kind of had to go away. And moving from elected official into, all right, instead of creating all of the policies that create the atmosphere for positive economic development and positive change in the community, what if I'm the person that's actually doing it and putting my money where my mouth is? And so that means it creates a conflict of interest that I can't be in policy at the moment if I'm doing this work over here in the world of development. And so I think it's understanding that, like, life has stages and phases where you glean something from one experience and it helps you to leverage that into the next experience. And then its season is probably over, very well might be over. And being grateful for the learning and continuing to move that forward into the next experience. There's not one thing that I have done that I regret, not one. They've all been really incredible learning opportunities. And I've always said, I can always go back to that thing if I feel called to do so. At this time, I continue to take the lessons that I've learned and leverage them to move forward. Take the lessons I've learned here and leverage them to move forward. And so it's very much if I grab onto something new here, it's time to sunset this other thing. Even in going after professional practice and licensure and owning a firm and all of that, teaching had to go. So I view teaching and mentoring inside of the firm as my kind of teaching role now, and it's not an on-campus teaching role. And so you're still using that to kind of educate and teach and mentor. It's just in a different form. And so I think understanding that this season is about these things, the previous season was about those things, is totally fine.
I resonate with that a lot because there's seasons of growth, there's seasons to prune,
yeah,
there's seasons to refine and, yep, then grow again. And it's a beautiful cycle and it feels more natural that way. I mentioned to you beforehand that I have been trying to apply bird analogies to what I see different architects doing. And the reason I'm choosing these birds is it's a way to describe natural marketing strategies, things that aren't arbitrary or man-made. You can absolutely follow those in a book, but the books always teach one way that marketing can be done. And I think the nature of being an entrepreneur, you're trying to do things in your own way, in a way that, like, if you can step up from your own strengths and just grow those, you can go so much further instead of having to fight back and learn to do things someone else's way.
Yeah.
And so if you're willing to hear a bird.
Game on.
All right, Angela, I think the bird that comes to mind is an American Dipper. And an American Dipper is a songbird, and it's the only songbird that can swim in the water. And the interesting thing about referrals is that I think of referrals as like backyard songbirds, where a neighbor has a songbird, they've put out the feed for it, and they get to enjoy their time with the bird, and they tell their neighbors, and they tell other people. And so other people start to put out feed for the bird, and the bird can kind of wander around. And so that's that kind of backyard songbird. Everyone wants to hear what the songbird is saying and see the beauty of it. So you're spreading your marketing message in that way. But with a dipper, they are also diving in to the water. And I think of the water as like, it's the construction process. Like flying free in the air. That is the visioning. That is the dreaming. And birds can do that so well. But only certain birds can survive diving into the water and come out still able to fly. And a dipper does it very well. And with the breadth of experience you have with construction, it sounds like you seamlessly fly in the air dreaming, but you're also flying through the water in a beautiful way to get projects that are in construction and in development and still come out. Dippers also build their own nests near the water. And so they build and leave a physical presence that remains. And so it's a fun tie-in in many ways because it's a complicated bird, but you don't have a complicated life. You don't seem to have a complicated process when practice when you describe it, but you are achieving a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And I think when you kind of break it down, you are this one person and you are this one ideal that you're following through these seasons. I think it's really informative and it helps us describe the nuance of practice. And I think there needs to be more storytelling about how architects are practicing differently, not just following the word by word pro practice books that we all had to read to pass our exams.
I think that's an interesting way to frame it, Katie. I like it.
Well, Angela, do you have anything else you'd like to make sure we share?
No, I think this has been such a great conversation. Thanks so much for the invitation, Katie. It's so fun to talk to somebody who understands South Dakota and rural places and the amount of advocacy that we have to do here to just help people understand what it is that architects contribute to communities. I think that's something that our urban counterparts may not understand, as we spend a lot of our time not marketing ourselves, but marketing architecture as a profession. and so it's really helpful to have that sort of kindred spirit on the other side of the conversation. So thanks.
Thank you. Really appreciated your time today. And this was just delightful to have this conversation with you.
It's my pleasure.
Angie Boersma has built an unapologetically rural practice by being a generalist. When it comes to practicing in a dozen different project types, she doesn't just dabble. She dove in. She found ways to invest in these communities to help them navigate through the currents of financing and the review processes that bring multi-generational change to these towns. Like an American Dipper, she is letting her voice be heard, diving into turbulent waters and leaving a lasting impact wherever she works. There are three essential qualities of an American Dipper type practice that can help a sole practitioner dive outside your element. First, dive in. Don't be afraid to step into other roles of an architectural project. As architects, we design projects, but any project is also shaped by regulations, finances, and construction. The qualifications for these roles overlap with architectural skills, and the project benefits by leveraging professional architectural perspective through a new aspect of the project. In terms of regulations, these can be planning or zoning committees, historic preservation commissions, or even public office. When serving as the project architect, these regulations seem to stifle our design intent. But by crossing into regulation and diving into this role, an architect can learn and possibly influence the intent of the rules. It may help you make a clearer case when presenting a new design to these regulatory boards. Another discipline to dive into is project financing. The highest level decision maker is often the person paying for the project. Some call it the power of the purse. Several architects, including Angie, are taking on the role of developer. This allows you to become your own client and make the financial case for your proposed design. This responsibility will also shape your practice as you consider the end user and market rates for a proposed project. The last role we will consider is construction. An architect can become a general contractor or run a design build firm. This puts the completion of the project in the hands of the architect building it. All the details, all the materials, all the work. Where other projects rely on a strong relationship between architect and contractor, you have ultimate control if you are the one building it. These extra roles can complement a sole practitioner's practice, but they can also take time, which leads to our second takeaway: embrace the seasons. Joining a board, arranging project finances, or constructing a project each take time, away from being an architect. If you dive in too far, they can become your full-time job. But for a generalist architect, someone just dabbling in adjacent disciplines for the sake of a project, there needs to be a boundary around how much this role pulls you away from your other responsibilities. One way to create that boundary is to make it temporary, to only dive in for a season. Whether you give it 3 months or 2 years or more, setting a timeline can help you invest in these efforts. Knowing that this effort won't drag on indefinitely helps contain the effort towards a project. Some may scoff at the idea of taking on any additional roles, even for a season. Now, the counterargument to this is that you may already be working all the time, so why take on another role? The answer is our final takeaway: to build a rounded architectural practice. Some architects refine their practice by diversifying their services. Switching project types is one way to manage economic trends. During past recessions, many architects switched from residential to government projects. Or during government shutdowns, some architects transitioned to corporate projects or residential. By diversifying your project experience with side roles, you can build connections beyond your traditional network. An American Dipper leverages their experience to swim and fly. An architect building this kind of practice will take on new opportunities as they arise. Angela had to build this kind of practice because of the nature of rural communities. There isn't a single type of architecture repeated over and over again in a small town. A community may only build one hotel or franchise or community center or school every 50 years. Angela's firm did follow these project types to spread their services across the region. But once she gets to know a community, she takes the next step of building relationships to be available for other architectural needs. She is able to leverage the variety of services architects can provide to fill in the gaps for that community. This generalist attitude has sustained her firm through economic uncertainty. And it starts from the nest. It is how she is training her interns with a holistic view of architectural practice. If you are building a generalist practice, unapologetically take on side roles and side projects. These opportunities diversify your skills and create leverage into new project types and regions. You may get pushback from traditionalist architects, but you are carving a different path. You are breaking boundaries. Like an American Dipper, you can let your voice be heard while diving into turbulent waters to leave a lasting impact wherever you work. This episode was brought to you in collaboration with Entree Architect, which is a fantastic community for finding like-minded entrepreneurs who are there to support you in your business journey. Please subscribe, share, and join the Flying Solo Movement community. We are just taking flight. Please join this journey for ongoing inspiration, support, and resources. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Katie Kengis. My hope is to encourage aspiring entrepreneurs and architects to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.